We are back with a new episode of the Sunday Morning Grind podcast. Greg Finley, Josh Taylor, episode 61. Josh had an idea for what we were going to name this, but we came up with a different idea. Josh, what were we going to go with?
I was originally thinking Sean Mahan, which was the first name that came to my mind, former Steelers center from, I believe it was 2003 to, what, maybe 2009, I think was his last season as a Steeler. But you found a better one, and I thought this was a lot more Pittsburgh-ish and more fitting.
Going with Gift and GoPay episode.
The Gift and GoPay episode's perfect. I love it.
Such a good last name.
That is so great. How often do you get to talk about a South African baseball player? I mean, honestly. It's fantastic.
Josh,
as a Pirate, it has been a while.
Yeah.
It has totally been a while. I was going to mention Gift Ngope was a Pirate for 28 games, and then he was a Toronto Blue Jay for 13. So,
but those 28 games that he was a Pirate, he had some pretty cool highlight moments.
Yeah, he had some special moments. I mean, he had 222. You know, he had a couple of extra base hits, drove in 6 runs, and walked 8 times. So, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't a total embarrassment.
Well, it's good that
you've seen worse.
It's good that we're back. I had some issues last week. You had a couple of things going on. We just decided not to do an episode, and so my one friend Andy, who listens to us every week, asked me what was going on, and I just said, "Hey, it was just one of those weeks, man." And I said, "But we'll be back. Talk about conference championships."
Yeah, good to step away.
Yeah, yeah. So I said, "We'll talk conference championships."
Yeah, it was good to step away.
Yeah, so we took a break, and now we're back, and we got a lot to talk about. We've got two great football games this weekend. First, Kansas City and Philadelphia, and then Cincinnati and Kansas City. Honestly, Josh, I look at both of these games as like game of the year type games. Like Philadelphia and San Francisco was your dream matchup for the NFC Championship when we first talked about playoffs?
It was.
This was what you wanted.
That was what I wanted.
And you're getting it.
Yeah, it was exactly what I was expecting. And probably you're looking at two of the best rosters in the league. And that's not even a probably. That's a definite. San Francisco and Philadelphia are the two most well-built rosters in this entire league. I mean, they have depth everywhere. San Francisco's got a pro bowler pretty much in every unit. Philly, I heard this and it blew my mind. Philly has what? I think 8 or 9 pro bowlers and then like 9 alternates. So they got like 17, 18 guys that have pro bowl consideration or they're already going to the pro bowl. It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous the number of pro bowlers that both of these teams have and the ridiculously deep rosters and homegrown rosters, I might add, that these two teams have. And it's funny because people keep trying to use these two teams as a comparison, but not for the reasons that they should. They use these two teams as comparisons for why do they have the offenses that they have and better play callers. And I'm looking at them going, do you look at their rosters? Have you looked at their offensive lines? Their offensive lines are the two best offensive lines probably in this game. Here's more craziness that I could even conjure up here. Philadelphia has two players that combined between the two of them, Greg, have allowed one sack in the past two seasons.
Just
between
one.
Jason Kelsey and Lane Johnson have combined to allow a single sack in the past two seasons.
I wish I had that on my team.
I don't know how you don't have an offense as successful as theirs if you only give up one sack between your center and your right tackle. And I forget the actual number, but someone had actually looked up the numbers for when Lane Johnson starts for the Eagles. They don't lose a lot when Lane Johnson plays, like to kind of give the spoiler alert there. It's pretty good when Lane Johnson's on the field. And you got an offensive line that's not only talented, not only are they good, but they're homegrown and they've been with that organization for a long time, at least for the most of them. You know, Isaac Seumalo, and it just you go down the list of names that this group has. It's really, really ridiculous how good they are. Then you look at San Francisco on their side. They got Trent Williams, who might be the best offensive lineman in the game. He's at your left tackle, and then the right tackle is Mike McGlinchey, a guy who got with the 9th overall pick like 5 years ago. Both of these teams have ridiculously built offensive lines and ridiculously built defensive lines. They are so stocked in the trenches that it should not shock you that both of these teams are pretty high as far as scoring offense and scoring defense. It should not surprise you at all. That's how good they are.
Well, the 49ers had a little bit of a scare with the Cowboys last week where, you know, Dallas looked like they were in that game until the final drive where they just completely went full-blown Dallas Cowboys. But they were in that football game, and I'm thinking, you know, the 49ers at home only beat Dallas by 7 in a 19-12 game. It didn't look great. And you're going to go up against a team like Philly. You need to make it ugly, but you can't have your offense only put up 19 points, right?
Yeah, I think the saving grace for San Francisco is that their defense was that good and Dallas's offense was that ineffective. And honestly, for me, the real separation for Dallas, like that line of demarcation for me, came when Tony Pollard went out in the first half.
That was a
when they lost
blow.
Tony Pollard.
Yep.
That was like the biggest piece of their offense that they couldn't afford to lose because it took their running game right off the table. And when this team can't run, when Dallas can't run, their offense is ineffective because you have Dak Prescott throwing the ball 30, 40, 50 times a game. And when he does that, things don't go well. He had 39 attempts, and I think he completed like, what, 22 of them, had a couple of interceptions, and it just they found ways to make mistakes in this game. And that's not even counting the last play from scrimmage for Dallas because that was just awful. But, I mean, they were in that position where if you were Dallas, you did not want to become one-dimensional. And that's exactly what happened. And San Francisco, to their credit, I mean, they didn't completely blow them out of the water, but, you know, gave them credit for taking advantage of it. They knew that they weren't going to have to score a bunch of points to keep Dallas at bay because once Dallas couldn't run the ball and they were forced to throw it, they were in trouble. And I think the 49ers knew it. I think the Cowboys knew it too. And the result of it has been, you know a big rash of firings on Dallas's staff. Running backs coach got fired. I think their offensive line coach, defensive line coach, I think five assistants altogether got fired, but Mike McCarthy sticks around. And I feel like this is one of those things where I'm not blaming the coaching staff. I thought the fact that, you know, this offense was what it was all season long, and then you run into this problem where you can't do the things that you do best to set up other things that you do well, I think it became a problem. And I'm not blaming that on coaching. I don't think that's kind of fair to those guys. And it'll be interesting to see what happens with Dallas moving forward because I felt like this was one of their best good shots to try to make a run deep in the playoffs, and it just didn't come together for them.
I mean, how many more times are the Cowboys going to have a great regular season and then fall flat come playoff time? And how many more times is Dak going to be the problem and they're still going to defend this guy and they're still going to fire coaches, but they're not going to be accountable for their quarterback? I mean, bottom line is Dak lost them that football game. He had the turnovers in bad situations, and I'm sorry, but you can't turn the ball over two times against the 49ers. And I get it, Tony Pollard was out, but they could have still ran Zeke, and they made Dak throw the ball 37 times. Zeke only ran the ball 10 times in that game.
I tell people this, and they keep looking at me like I'm crazy, or they say the opposite when they're talking about this, whether they're talking about any other team or the Steelers. And I keep telling them, the later it gets in the year, the more important it is to win the turnover battle, because you do not want to make mistakes in a game like this if you're Dallas, especially against a team like that, if you're San Francisco. If I'm Mike McCarthy, I'm looking across the field, I'm going, I got to try to stop that. I got to try to stop that team that pretty much embodies little giants. Like, we're going to kick the ball off to you, then we're going to take it from you, and we're going to ram it down your throat. Or if you kick it over to us, we're going to ram it down your throat. That's the team they were facing. And they gave that team extra possessions. Yep. It doesn't shock me that Dallas lost that game, because if they don't give them extra possessions, maybe they do have a shot at it. Maybe with a more functional run game, having Tony Pollard, maybe they do have a shot at beating San Francisco. But, you know, to your point, talking about Dak Prescott, here's the part that, you know, you still got to look at as far as Dallas is concerned. You know what his cap number is for next year, Greg?
It's going to be high.
$49.1 million. Dude, 31 of it guaranteed,
dude,
for next year.
He's not worth that. I mean, they overpaid him, no doubt about it. But, I mean, that is one of the worst contracts he is not that good. He's yet to get them to the NFC Championship.
Mm-hmm. And here it gets better. 2024 is cap hits 52. So you know the two words I'm going to offer next for Dallas. Good luck.
Good luck.
I don't see how this gets any better. And I mean, not to mention the fact we're talking about them losing Tony Pollard. He's a free agent after this season. So that's another situation they have to try to figure out. Hey, are you going to try to bring Tony Pollard back? How much are you going to pay him? How much is he worth to you? All of this adds up now because you got to figure out just how you're going to put this team together, knowing you got to pay your quarterback almost $50 million of cap space. So all of this is really, you know, it's a rough situation for Dallas. So for them to go out the way they did, knowing what they have to face in the offseason, makes it feel even worse.
Okay, to the other side now. The Philadelphia Eagles ran through the New York Football Giants. I mean, absolutely ran through them from start to finish. I didn't expect the Giants to win that game, but I expected it to be a little bit closer than 38-7. Is it more of Philly's a complete unit and you don't see them losing this Sunday, or was it just a mismatch with the Giants?
It was Philly. Actually, a little bit of both, because Philly is a complete unit and they were playing against the Giants. The Giants weren't equipped to face a team like Philly. And I said this, what, 2 months ago, that Philly was my pick to win the Super Bowl? This is what's crazy about Philly. I mean, now bear in mind, they lost their quarterback for a handful of games. They still finished third in the league in yards and third in the league in points. And they still finished ninth in the league in passing yards. And they were fifth in rushing yards. That's just on the offensive side. Defensive, they were eighth in points allowed and second in total defense. They were the best team against the pass. And they were 16th against the run. Like, this is a team that just, you can't get it easy against this team. And, oh, yeah, by the way, they led the team to sacks, too. There's so much here with this Philly team that makes them so difficult to face. And I don't think people really realize just how good they were. And if I'm not mistaken, as far as the sack numbers go too, I want to say it's like the third most number of sacks for a team since sacks started being recorded in the early 80s. They had 70 sacks, Greg. 70 this season.
That's ridiculous.
It's insane how good this defense was. Yeah, and I mean, the Steelers led, they were tied with the 49ers for the most interceptions. Well, Philly was tied for fourth with Buffalo with 17.
Is it crazy for me to say then that, I mean, Brock Purdy didn't see a defense like Dallas, but now he's not going to see a defense like Philly?
Oh, he hasn't seen a defense like Philly. The only defense he might have seen that was better than Philly was his own.
And his own in practice.
And that might be the thing that helps him prepare, because he sees the best defense in the game in practice. But, man, I mean, if San Francisco is the best defense in the league, if they're number one, then Philly's 1A, because that defense is really, really good. When you're the number one defense against the pass in a passing league and you've got 70 sacks on the quarterback and 17 picks, you're doing something right. And they were plus eight in the turnover margin, I might add. So this is – when you look at how the numbers stack, everything points toward Philly and how this team is a Super Bowl-caliber team. And that's why I've been saying that for the past couple months now. They're really, really good. And you saw how good they were against the Giants. And everybody's like, oh, the Giants are terrible. I'm sitting there going, did you see Philly this year? Did you see how they played all season long?
And yeah, they
come back to the two games they had against – I mean, they go back to the two games they had against the Cowboys. And I'm going – okay, wait a minute. Well, they didn't have – I mean, I'm trying to think.
They had Jalen Hurts in Dallas one game, but they had Gardner Minshew in the other one.
Right, and Dak didn't play in the first game for the Cowboys.
No, it was Cooper Rush.
You know, it was Cooper Rush. So you have to remind people, like, that's the one game Dallas lost with Cooper Rush in there. But then the second time when they played the Cowboys, the Eagles didn't have Jalen Hurts. So, like, there's a reason why that series was split the way it was. Mm-hmm. And I know people wanted to see that rematch for the third time around. And I'm going, no, you don't. Not with Jalen Hurts healthy. You don't want to see that rematch because it won't go well for Dallas. If Dallas wasn't going to do that well with San Francisco, would you think they were going to do it Philly? It wasn't going to be much of an easier scenario with that offense healthy, everybody together, and that defense still roaming the planet. They're really, really good. That's why this game is so interesting to me, because you get two offenses that are loaded with weapons, and you got two defenses that are loaded with playmakers. And they're the two top teams in the NFC, and they were pretty much all season, and they removed all doubt really, really early on.
Okay, we move on now to the AFC Championship, where we're getting it again. Last year we got it with the Bengals and the Chiefs. We're getting Bengals-Chiefs again. And, you know, Josh, Joe Burrow has beaten Patrick Mahomes in three straight games. Patrick Mahomes comes into this game not 100% healthy. And the Bengals right now are riding high. They just beat Buffalo in Buffalo. No problem, it looked like. I mean, they handled their business, no problem. I'm very concerned about Kansas City in this game. Like, I think the Bengals are the team to beat strictly because Joe Burrow is just balling out at a higher level than any other quarterback in the AFC right now, or even in the National Football League. I mean, what this guy's been doing, he is on one, and it seems like nobody can stop him.
Well, let's take this a step further, because not only can they not stop Joe Burrow, I don't think they could stop Cincinnati's offense as a whole, because there's one element to this, and people keep saying, oh, well, Joe Burrow and the passing offense and all of this other stuff. And all of that's true. All of it's true. But there's something Cincinnati figured out in the second part of the season, and when they use it and it works, it makes them even better. The Bengals are starting to become a little bit more comfortable running the football. And they ran for 172 yards last week against Buffalo. In Buffalo.
In the snow.
That's something in the snow. Like, you can't ignore that part. What they did against the Bills last week, and I'm going to remind people, you know, the Bills are one of the best defenses in the league this year. They were fifth against the run. They were second in yards and sixth in yards allowed. So they were second in points and sixth in yards allowed. They were the fifth-ranked defense against the run. And they ran for 172 yards against the fifth-ranked run defense in the league. That's what Cincy did last week. And they did that with a handful of offensive linemen out. And they said, we don't care. We're going to strap up and do whatever we want on offense, including running the football if we have to. And that's exactly what they did, and it worked. I mean, they threw for 240, but they ran for 172. That offense, like, when you light up Buffalo for 400-plus, you're doing something right. And Cincy right now is doing everything right. They are peaking at the absolute perfect time. Something else to point out with Cincinnati, seven of their last eight games, I think including this past win against Buffalo, they've won the turnover margin in seven of their last eight games. They're doing everything right, both on offense and on defense. I think that's what makes them dangerous because, you know, yeah, they beat Buffalo, they beat Baltimore at home, but they went on the road to beat Buffalo. They went on the road to beat Josh Allen and to make Josh Allen miserable. Like, this is a really, really interesting feat that Cincinnati pulled off. And now they have to go to Arrowhead and face the Chiefs team that I think they can go stride for stride with. Just like they went stride for stride with them last year. I think they can do this again. I think Kansas City should be worried about A, Joe Burrow, and B, that run game. Because Kansas City's defense is not as strong as some of the other teams that Cincinnati's had to face. Remember, they went from facing Baltimore back-to-back games to then facing Buffalo. And Kansas City's defense, it ain't Baltimore's and it ain't Buffalo's. So this will be an interesting matchup just for the fact that, you know, Cincinnati seems to be doing all the right things at all the right times, but Kansas City has been able to do just enough, whether it's, you know, scoring enough points or just doing it on defense. I mean, they've blown a couple teams out, but they're haven't been that many. They've covered the spread that much. And those of us who are watching the hot sheet know this because they've let us down quite a few times. But they do just enough to win games. But now you're facing a Cincy team where just enough might not work because they can find ways to make it hard for you.
Yeah, Patrick Mahomes comes down with an injury in that game against the Jaguars. Chad Henne comes in and plays hero ball and saves them. But then they bring Mahomes back into the game. He's able to play through it. He says that he's fine. I think he's okay. I think he'll be able to play no problem in this game. But, yeah, I mean, I just look at this matchup, and you talked about Kansas City's defense. I mean, they let Trevor Lawrence kind of do his thing against them and made that game a lot closer than I think a lot of people thought it was going to be. And Cincinnati put up 27 points on Buffalo and only gave up 10. The Bengals' defense has been solid, which means that Kansas City's defense is going to have to make stops against Joe Burrow and this Bengals offense, and I don't know if it's going to happen. So you've got the Eagles to win, and then you've got the Bengals. Is it going to be Eagles-Bengals? Is that your Super Bowl?
Yeah, I got Philly and Cincy. I can't shake the feeling of Philly and Cincy. That's one road team and one home team. Because they're playing the NFC game in Philly, right?
Yes.
Yeah, so yeah, I got one home team in Philly and one road team in Cincy.
I've got San Francisco and Kansas City.
Wow.
But here's why.
Wow.
Here's
opposite
why.
Sides of the coin. Wow.
Here's why. Because I think too many people are doubting Patrick Mahomes. They were 2.5-point favorites.
That's fair.
They got dropped all the way to 1.5-point underdogs at home. Mahomes is an underdog at home? Are you kidding me? Now it's a straight pick 'em.
Yeah, after the ankle injury got out and they saw that there might be an issue there, they kind of changed that line. But it's since stabilized. I mean, Patrick Mahomes has been a full participant in practice. So you see that with that ankle injury, and he's a full participant, he's going to be fine. And Andy Reid talked about it because Mahomes had a really serious ankle injury before, and he came back after that injury and threw for like 400 plus.
Right.
So he came back from that one. And Andy Reid is saying, hey, this one isn't as bad as the last one was. So if this injury isn't as bad as the previous one, and he came back from the previous one with his hair on fire, just imagine what he might do in this one. And honestly, like, I look at what Patrick Mahomes does, and I don't think he's the reason why the Chiefs could lose this game. I just wonder if Cincinnati comes out as hot and as aggressive as they did against Buffalo, and I think they should, by the way. I think Cincy should be aggressive here and try to come out as hot as they can. I think Cincy's playing with house money. So if you can do that against Kansas City the same way you did against Buffalo, I like their chances.
Yeah, I just think too many people are on the Bengals. I mean, it's like 83% of tickets are on the Bengals, and that's a lot of tickets against Patrick Mahomes.
It's a lot of tickets against Patrick Mahomes. It's a lot to put on Joe Burrow, and I'm not putting it all on Joe Burrow. I think it's the fact that since he's just a complete team, and they weren't always a complete team, I think they became a complete team as the season went along. I mean, it got weapons. You can throw it to a bunch of different dudes. You can throw it to Hurst. You can throw it to Higgins. You can throw it to
Chase.
You can throw it to Jamar Chase. You can throw it to Tyler Boyd. You can run it with Mixon and Pirine. Like, they've got – I'd take their weapons over Kansas City's weapons because Kansas City's actually downgraded. Now, if you're talking about their weapons from last year when they still had Tyreek Hill, you're probably talking about a different kind of looking team. But as far as skill positions now, Cincy's skill position guys, I think, are a notch or two ahead of Kansas City's. And now the one thing that does come back to my mind is that Kansas City's offensive line is healthier. So they're probably having an easier time protecting Patrick Mahomes than Cincy might have protecting Joe Burrow. So, and not to mention the fact that Cincy's defense is probably a little bit better too, as far as their pass rush and being able to get to KC's defense in pass rush are probably a little bit better as far as being able to get to Joe Burrow. So that's a different situation too. I'm curious to see how this works on both sides of it, because yeah, we know what the quarterbacks can do. We know what the skill position guys can do. For me, who plays better up front, who keeps their quarterback cleaner, and who gets in the other quarterback's face more? I think it's going to be a difference in this game, and who runs the ball better, of course.
And can Cincinnati stop Travis Kelce? Because if he cooks them, it's game over. If you get cooked by him, and then you focus only on him, then guys like Juju and Tony will do their damage. McKinnon will do his damage out of the backfield because they've worked him into this offense very well and effectively as a dual threat running back. And yeah, I mean, I'm so excited for these games. These are both going to be fun games. And other side of I gave you why I like Kansas City. I like San Francisco just because what I've seen from this team all season long. They are a gritty bunch, and they don't let anybody get in their way. I mean, you lose Jimmy Garoppolo after you already lost Trey Lance, and you go down to your third-string quarterback, who was the final pick in the draft, and you rattle off 7 wins in a row. You go get Christian McCaffrey, and he was such a big get for them. And these guys are loaded, man. They're absolutely loaded. And I just think that Philly coasted too much against the Giants, and the 49ers might be a team that just runs into these guys with their physicality on offense and defense, and the 49ers come away victorious.
Well, there's something that I read earlier this week, and they were talking about how Philly had the easiest schedule in the league. But here was the list of opponents that San Francisco had. At Chicago, they lost that game. This team lost to the Bears in week one, which is weird. at home against Seattle, on the road against Denver, where they lost 11-10, but they were banged up in that game. They had a lot of guys hurt. Home against the Rams, they beat them. Home at Carolina, they beat them. Home against the Falcons, or I should say at the Falcons, lost there. Home against Kansas City and lost. At LA against the Rams, home against the Chargers. At Arizona, home against New Orleans, home against Miami, home against Tampa, at Seattle, home against Washington, at Vegas, and home against Arizona.
That's not a hard schedule.
After the bye week, their schedule got ridiculously easy. I mean, think about this. They went on the road to face the Rams in week eight, and they never lost again.
Yep.
that's the part that's crazy. That's the part that's scary for me. Like, they never lost after week eight. That's just nuts. They've won, what, 11 games in a row? But, yeah, you're right. I mean, I've been talking about San Francisco for how long now as far as what their roster is and what their offense can do? And I've used this example a couple times now. I think it was against Seattle. They lined up in a broken eye formation with Deebo Samuel in the backfield behind Kyle Juszczyk, and they had Christian McCaffrey split to the right side as a wide receiver. So, of course, you're thinking Deebo in the backfield going, okay, they're going to run the ball with Deebo. No, they run a slant with McCaffrey and pick up a first down. How many teams can do that? How many teams can do that with their personnel and totally head fake the team that they're facing? That's how multifaceted and how versatile just that base, you know, 21 group with two receivers, a tight end, and two running backs, and even using the fullback use check. They can spread these guys out. They can line them up anywhere. They can line the receiver up in the backfield and the running back in the as split out as receiver. They can spread these guys out five wide. They can do whatever they want with this group. And a lot of people are saying, oh, well, Kyle Shanahan is a great offensive genius. And I'm not taking away from him, but you give any offensive coordinator that kind of skill position group, they're going to tinker with that group too and do fun things like that too, because they just have that much talent. Here's another thing to point out. This weekend, this conference championship weekend, you talk about Travis Kelce in the AFC game. You got George Kittle in the NFC game. You probably got the two best tight ends in the league playing this weekend.
How about that catch he made last week?
Let's do it.
That catch that he made?
Oh, my God, that was insane concentration. Yeah. I mean, the crazy part about it was the more I saw him deflect it, the more I'm like, wait a minute, he might catch this thing.
I thought the same thing.
The more he did, the better shot he had at catching, and that's exactly what happened. But that's the talent that this team has, man. And I've been talking about San Francisco for a couple weeks on my own radio show, just how deep this roster is, because, of course, Steelers fans not knowing how to keep their own grass green, and I was looking at the grass on the other side being green. They're always asking, like, well, why can't the Steelers offense do what San Francisco does? Because you don't have a George Kittle and a Christian McCaffrey and a Deebo Samuel and a Brandon Ayuk and a Trent Williams and a Mike McGlinchey. That's why.
Yep.
That's why you can't do what they do, because you don't have the personnel they have. I'll take San Francisco's tackles over the Steelers' tackles. I'll take San Francisco's wide receivers over the Steelers' wide receivers as a whole. I'll take San Francisco's running backs over the Steelers' running backs. And I will take their starting tight end over the Steelers' starting tight end. Their personnel across the board is just better, period. That's why. There's a reason why this team hasn't lost in 11 games, because their personnel is just good. Their defensive line is just good. They may have the best linebacker in the game in Fred Warner. And I might be talking myself out of picking Philadelphia and going with San Francisco, because as much as I talk this team up, they're really that good. I mean, their two best linebackers are Fred Warner and Dre Greenlaw, whom I covered in high school at Fayetteville High School in Fayetteville, Arkansas, before he went to the University of Arkansas. Those two guys are third-round picks and fifth-round picks, respectively. This is how good that team has drafted and developed over the last half decade to become what they are now. And then you add Trent Williams to free agency, you trade for Jimmy Garoppolo, and everything else, the rest of this team is pretty much homegrown. And it's sickening to see this team built the way it is. And I haven't even gotten into guys like Talanoa Hufanga. I haven't talked about Bosa. I haven't talked about Eric Armstead. Just this crazy wealth of talent that San Francisco has put together. And we wonder why they're that good. They're that good because they built this team well. They developed them well. And they work around these guys' skill sets incredibly efficiently.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, I want to play our favorite news headline game because we haven't played that in a while.
Yes.
This is episode 61, Sunday Morning Grind Podcast, brought to you by Ethos Life. We will be right back. The Sunday Morning Grind Podcast is presented by Ethos Life. Get up to $2 million in life insurance the easy way with Ethos. Skip the medical exam and weeks of waiting. With just a few health and lifestyle questions, Ethos approves up to 95% of applicants in about 10 minutes with coverage from trusted carriers. Tailor your policy to fit your budget and get help from licensed agents whenever you need it. Ethos provides instant coverage for more families than any other provider and a top-rated experience customers love. In the time it takes to drink your morning coffee, you can get peace of mind for your family today with Ethos.
This is not becoming a thing. No, this is not a thing.
I'm pretty sure it's a thing.
It's not a thing.
It's not a thing.
We'll go with it.
Make it a thing.
Oh, it's a thing now.
Yeah. Let's go for it.
Love that.
Oh, perfect.
Everyone loves a little more flavor. Nobody wants vanilla.
What are the big three?
What big three?
The big three.
What big three?
Androids, aliens, and wizards.
That's not a thing.
That's definitely a thing.
No, it's not.
So every time we fight one of the three.
So who are you fighting now, Gandalf?
How do you know about Gandalf?
I read The Hobbit in 1937 when it first came out.
So you see my point?
No. I don't.
And pose the question, how is this not a thing? Because while there are many things in this world that should no longer be things, there are also many non-things that should absolutely be thingified, brought into the thing-sistence, if you will. You know, like an all-dog version of the Blue Man Group. Or, exactly. What? How is that not a thing?
All right, welcome back to the Sunday Morning Grind Podcast. It's time for our favorite news headline game. Is this a thing? And Josh, we broke out the awesome montage that we've used before for our Is This a Thing specials.
I miss that, man. I miss that drop so bad. It's so great. It never gets old.
Right?
I love it.
It's great. It's, I mean, you talked about it off air, but it pretty much summarizes our entire lives. Baseball, wrestling, Marvel, John Oliver.
Yeah, it encapsulates the things that we probably talk about more than anything, so that's perfect. But yeah, it's turned into its own, like, growing living organism. Like, even the drop to Is This a Thing has become a thing. Like, irony strikes again. I love it.
And fantastic. You know that with, you know, only a couple more weeks left of football that we're going to be doing some Is This a Thing specials again. It's coming.
Oh, yes.
It is coming.
Yes. The entire Is This a Thing specials, and they will get insane. And we pick crazy as our music for a reason, because it will get crazy. It won't be golfer or CFL player crazy, but it might get close. It can get close.
All right. Let's start with let me just get this one out of the way. The New York Mets are apparently already trying to make noise, as reports have already come out that they are going after Shohei Ohtani when his contract is up with the Angels, which, as a Mets fan, you know that I would love Shohei Ohtani, but also as a Mets fan, I know that I'm probably not going to get what I want here. My question to you is, will the Mets break my heart again, or are they really going to get Shohei Ohtani?
Well, first of all, I think they will pursue Shohei Ohtani. I think that is a thing, but I also think them breaking your heart is also a thing. So if you're asking me if I think they're going to get him, my answer would be no. I will say this much. As a person who has family in the New York area, I would love to see Shohei Ohtani become a Met. I would love for an excuse to visit, you know, my in-laws next time and say, hey, why don't we go down to this city field and watch the Mets play. I hear Ohtani's pitching. Absolutely a BL for that. So, yeah, I don't think it'll happen, but I would love to see it happen. If for no other reason, I might be able to get a chance to witness it. But, yeah, as far as the Mets actually getting Shohei Ohtani, they're going to find a way to Mets this up. So their pursuit is a thing, but getting him is not a thing.
According to sources, Steve Cohen has already been talking openly to upper-level Mets people about going after Ohtani this winter. I mean, come on, man. He couldn't get Correa because that whole thing blew up in their face. But if he can get Ohtani, for this season, oh man, I will lose my mind.
You know, he is going to throw a not even ridiculous, not even insane, not even absurd, not even stupid money. He's going to throw ludicrous money at Shohei Ohtani to get him to become a Met. And he will throw money that will be so ludicrous that that plane ride that goes to New York after he signs, people will look up at it and say, it's the Mets. They've gone to Plaid. It'll be just like that scene from Spaceballs because it will be ludicrous.
But how much would they have to give up to get that guy? Because if he wants to go after him this winter, money's not going to be the thing yet. He's got to trade for him.
Yeah, if you're going after him, well, he's what, one more year of arbitration?
Yes.
Ohtani does?
Yes.
Well, if he has one more year of arbitration, is it after this season?
I believe so.
Okay, yeah, you would have to trade for him in the winter, in which case you'd have to trade for him, and then you'd have to offer him a contract to avoid arbitration. So if you're the Mets, A, you're going to have to draft, you have to trade for him, and then B, you're going to have to sign him to an extension that buys out that arbitration year, and then free agency afterwards. So you are talking, who's the highest paid player right now? Is it Mike Trout still, or did Bryce Harper pass him?
Oh, I think Juan Soto passed him.
Oh, sorry, Juan Soto passed both of them. That's right.
The Padres paid him stupid money.
They paid him stupid money, but it'll be. I mean, how much is Aaron Judge making? Like, this is.
Yeah, he's making stupid money too.
Look at the biggest names in the game right now, and then add a little bit more onto that, and then think about it. Like, well, how much more would it take for it to be ludicrous? And then add that number on. That's what it's going to be. It's going to be an insane amount of money, because you don't pay Shohei Ohtani like a regular player. You got to pay for him the fact that he as a pitcher is fantastic, and the fact that he is a position player as a hitter is pretty fantastic as well. He's a dynamic guy from two different areas of the game. You got to pay that guy top dollar, and the Mets are going to go top dollar and beyond, and it's going to be ludicrous. I expect a ludicrous offering of money for Shohei Ohtani.
So here's what the article says. Three factors will work against both the Yankees and Mets in pursuit of Ohtani. As one MLB executive pointed out, none of the seven finalists to sign Ohtani in 2017 were East Coast teams. In fact, the Cubs were the only club on the list who did not play in the American League or National League West. Now, there is a DH now in the National League, so I don't think that's going to be a problem, but the whole East Coast thing might be a problem. The entire industry expects the Dodgers to make a serious run at Ohtani next winter, although that doesn't preclude Cohen from outbidding them. Cohen might just be like, hey, Magic, what's your best offer? I'm going to double it.
It could get that crazy. Now, the Dodgers do have the upper hand. I'm glad someone pointed it out as far as the geography of it all, because New York is not that close to Japan. But at least if you're on the West Coast, that cuts that travel time down significantly.
Oh, he's already in L.A. too with the Angels.
Right.
So
already in California with the Angels. So if the Dodgers come knocking, and don't forget, the Dodgers can have offer a pretty ridiculous, ludicrous check too.
Yeah.
And they haven't gone as crazy in recent years with paying guys out. And you and I talked about it. We're sitting there going, are they kind of keeping quiet because they're in an Ohtani too?
No, they're 100% are.
That's been my feeling, because of all the teams that have gone nuts in free agency, the Dodgers have not been one of them. And I really think that's on purpose. No, I think they haven't gone nuts.
Their biggest move was Kershaw for another season.
Right. Another year Kershaw. I would not be surprised if the Dodgers are playing possum and not throwing a lot of money in the other guys and just saying, look, we're going to make Ohtani an offer he can't refuse, even better than Steve Cohen, or at least comparative or competitive with Steve Cohen. And they'll have the upper leg being out on the West Coast. I fully expect him to be a Dodger this time next year. And that's really nothing against the Mets. I just think the Dodgers will give him everything he's looking for, plus having the geographic proximity he wants too.
Wouldn't you rather play for the Dodgers, even if Cohen threw the book at you with how much money he's made of? If the Dodgers come knocking and they offer you something very close to that, aren't you going to be in Los Angeles because it's Los Angeles and it's the Dodgers?
Making nine figures, damn near $1 billion to live in LA? Absolutely.
Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely. And there's no snow and there's there's traffic because LA and New York both have ridiculous traffic, but there's no snow. There's no cold weather. I mean, look around. Look around when you step out the door in LA and look around when you step out the door in New York. I think it's pretty obvious, you know, why the advantage would be to live in LA. I would be taking the Dodgers money. I can't say I blame them.
Yep. Yep. I agree. Okay. I'll go one more and then you have three. Or actually, I have three and you have three. So I have two more. Okay. The second one, excuse me. This one's baseball related as well. Bally Sports Regional Sports Networks are preparing to file for bankruptcy per Bloomberg as the regional sports rights bubble officially pops. Clay Travis tweeted this the other day. And, you know, Bally Sports just recently became a thing when Fox Sportsnet folded and Bally Sportsnet was the company that came in to get the rights to sporting events like Major League Baseball, the NBA, the NHL. So my question to you is, if this happens, is this the end of, you know, Fox Sportsnet, Bally Sports, Comcast Sportsnet, all these major market entities, and teams are just going to be like the Dodgers with Sportsnet LA, with the Yankees with YES, the Mets with SNY? Is everybody just going to get their own station?
I think the ones in big enough markets are going to push for it. I think if you're in, you know, a top 10, top 15 media market, I think you'd be crazy not to try it. I think you've seen what happens with teams like the Mets having SNY, the Yankees having YES Network, even the Dodgers having the RSN deal that they've got, the Lakers having the RSN deal that they've got. I'm trying to think of other ones. The Red Sox having NESN. This is all outside baseball. Like, this is non-baseball revenue, and MLB doesn't cap. They don't have, you know, a limit as far as non-baseball revenue that you can collect. So this is something where every team that can actually get on board with it, they've got a loophole now to draw in a lot of extra money that doesn't come from what you earn on a baseball field or inside your baseball field to add to your coffers. And if you're capable of doing that, and it's not like these teams aren't, I mean, it's not like the infrastructure is that complicated because it's already in place. It's just a matter of finding somebody who's willing to write the checks to do it. But if you can do that yourself, you don't have to pay rights fees. And that's what makes this all the more compelling if you're a market that's capable of doing it. Do I think every team will do it? No, but I think teams in big enough markets, maybe top 10 to 15, I think they'll do it if they haven't done it already.
So then if that happens, maybe we finally see the end of local blackouts?
That is something that MLB would have to sort out on a league level. I'm not 100% certain. I don't know what would go into that. The league would have to come to that decision of blacking out games. And I don't know if that's something that happens with the RSNs or with the league itself. I feel like that's a league issue. So that's something that they would probably have to look into. But you'd like to hope so as a fan, right? Whatever it takes to bring to the end of blackout games, just bring them to an end. Some folks still like baseball out there. We still want to be able to see, you know, games, whether in our own market or other markets that might be subject to blackout. We just want to watch baseball.
And more,
let us watch baseball the way we want to.
And more people would like to get to the point where they don't have to pay for cable to watch their favorite sporting teams. Like, you buy MLB TV, you're thinking you're going to get every team, but
right. You
don't. Whenever you live in the market that you live in, you're not going to get pirate games whenever you live in Pittsburgh unless they were to remove the blackouts.
This is the one thing I will say that's cool about having NFL Plus, because I bought NFL Plus toward the end of the season. I can literally watch every game. Like, no game is blacked out. I can watch the games that I want to watch. If I'm in Pittsburgh, I can watch the Steelers play.
Live?
Yeah.
I can really
watch the game live. Yeah. Oh. That's the cool thing about NFL Plus. I was working a post-game show, and I was driving to work because I had left a little bit later than I planned. So instead of, like, just listening to the car on the radio, like, I was listening on the radio, like, while I was driving. But once I parked and I had to walk in the building, I put my earbuds in, turned to my phone, and had the phone playing at the phone play in the game on NFL Plus. So, yeah, if you have that option, and you remember where I work, I'm right across the river from Heinz Field. So I was, you know, less than a mile from Heinz Field watching a football game at Heinz Field on NFL Plus. It's possible.
Oh, that's
so
awesome.
When you're able to capitalize on that, as fans should be able to, hopefully MLB figures that out. When you're able to do that, you're going to get more fans connected to the game, and they should want that above anything else.
Okay. I have one more, and then I'll hand it off to you for yours. Barstool Sports put this tweet out the other day. Nobody loses to Kirk Cousins and gets away with it. The Cousins curse, Josh. No team has lost to Kirk Cousins and gone on to play in the Super Bowl. And the newest victim is Josh Allen and the Buffalo Bills when they lost to the Vikings on the fumble at the one-yard line in a game that they absolutely should have won. They lose that game to the Vikings, and now they are out after losing to the Bengals. The Kirk Cousins curse, is this a thing?
You're talking to a guy who says the Drake curse is a thing. So if the Drake curse is a thing, the Kirk Cousins curse has to be a thing. It's got to be. That's wow. That's mind blowing. I didn't know the Kirk Cousins curse even existed. But man, this is a thing. And it is a whole thing. This is crazy. I love this already.
Is it more proof how fraudulent the Vikings are?
I mean, we didn't need the Kirk Cousins curse to prove that the Vikings were fraudulent. Their defense was evidence enough
good
of
enough.
How fraudulent the Vikings were. I called them Minnesota for a reason because they were mid, man. That team was just absolutely mid.
They took
but
mid.
Yeah, this curse is a thing.
They took mid to a new level by the way
really
that
did.
They lost that game to the Giants.
And everyone's like, I don't understand how the Giants got to the second round. I do. They beat Minnesota.
Yeah. Everybody knew the Vikings were going to lose that game. Come on.
Yeah, come on. Vikings were mid all year.
They were so lucky that the Colts probably threw a game on purpose to try and get a higher draft pick they shouldn't have won that game. There's no way they should have won that game.
They had the biggest comeback in league history against a team they had no business falling that far behind
exactly.
against in Indianapolis. They had no business being that far behind.
Exactly.
Down 30-plus to the Colts who might bring back Jeff Saturday? What are we talking about?
Okay, I lied. We have a couple more, but I'm going to set you up for this one because I don't know. We didn't talk about it off air, but we have to talk about this.
Okay.
Your alma mater made news this week. And this is just an all-timer. Go ahead.
Oh, man. Duquesne. Duquesne facing Loyola Chicago this week at UPMC Cooper Fieldhouse, a place that I've grown to love as not only my alma mater's basketball stadium, but a place I work often as a color commentator and a play-by-play announcer. The men's team's playing Loyola Chicago. And at one point during the game, a person walks out onto the court, apparently carrying a bag as the people thought it was an Uber Eats driver, but it turned out to be they were dressed as a DoorDash driver carrying a supposed bag of McDonald's. And this isn't even a thing question because it's already been proven that it was a hoax and Duquesne has already confirmed it after the fact. But Greg, my question to you is, how is this a thing? How is it possible for someone to pretend to be a DoorDash driver carrying McDonald's walking onto the court of a Division I men's basketball game? How is this a thing?
Here's my answer. Fraternity, don't they make you do stuff to join the fraternity?
Oh yeah, yeah, pledging. They could easily. It's funny you mentioned that. It's funny you say that because one of my frat brothers reached out to me and goes, "Okay, so who's pledging right now that they got somebody on the floor?"
See, exactly.
And my response to him was, "You know, it's not our guys because our guys are my fraternity's pledges. Shout out to the brothers of Gamify Fraternity. Gamify pledges. You can tell when a Gamify pledge is walking around. Just look at their feet." It wasn't one of ours.
Are they not wearing shoes or what? What's the look at their
feet?
Well,
they were wearing shoes, but if you're a Gamify pledge, you wear white Chuck Taylors. And this kid had on Panda Dunks, so it's not a Gamma pledge.
Okay.
I can confirm that. So he's not one of ours. But yeah, how is this a thing? How is this kid able to just walk into this building? Clearly he had a ticket. And I mean, they found out afterwards he was like wearing a lavalier mic. So this was a stunt that someone had pulled up here and like someone put on and clearly they had him mic'd up trying to get some video of this thing. But like just walks onto the floor, unhindered, unabated, just walks on the floor. Absolutely insane.
So there was no order at all. He just walked in pretending that he was a DoorDash worker.
Yeah, this was a prank. And whoever it was, like after they got confronted, I think they just like walked back up into the crowd. So this was a premeditated prank and a well-planned one at that. So whoever did it, more power to him. But I was saying, and for those of you who understand the history of Duquesne basketball, you know this. Duquesne basketball, the men's basketball team, has not made the NCAA tournament in 45 years. So now, if I needed a reason to root for this team to make the tournament, I'm not rooting for my alma mater to make the tournament, just so I could say the Uber Eats game was the pivotal point in this season turning things around, because Duquesne won the game. By the way, Duquesne came back down double digits to beat Loyola. So they came back and won this game.
Was this after this happened?
Like, I think the rally happened after the DoorDash appearance. I have to double check that.
I'm not saying that he was good luck, but I'm not saying it either.
you see where I'm going with this? Like, okay, the DoorDash game, that was the pivotal point in this season where things changed and this team made the tournament. I'm rooting for it now. If there's a season where Duquesne makes a tournament, it has to be where a DoorDash driver or a fake DoorDash driver comes out on the floor during the game. It's got to be.
Oh, that's incredible. And shout out to Tim Benz and Ellis Cannon.
Oh, my God. They were great.
They killed it. They absolutely killed it.
Absolutely great. Fantastic work from those guys. They were incredible. Definitely shout out to Tim and Ellis. And I've worked with both of those guys this year. And I'm hoping I get a chance to do another game with them, or at least one of them, so I can go, okay, so you got to tell me the story. You got to tell me everything you saw, because I want to hear it. I think this will be fantastic.
All right, you got a couple more?
Yeah, I got a couple. Let's go to the NFL here. It's no secret that Eli Apple has become a lot of people's favorite player to hate in the NFL.
Yeah.
And this was a great pickup by a Jets cornerback, Sauce Gardner, who tweeted out, "Eli Apple is the Patrick Beverly of the NFL." Greg, is this a thing?
110%, man. I mean, first of all Pat Bev does is just anger every opponent that he goes up against and just trolls them to no. I mean, come on. When the Lakers were getting beaten to a pulp by the Blazers and they came all the way back and he did the Dame time and looked at the fake watch and was like, was this good. Thing ain't working. I mean, that was such a good troll by him.
That was pretty, I gotta admit, that was a good one. I can't even lie.
But yeah, you go on social media and Eli Apple is just getting absolutely buried by not teammates, but fellow colleagues of the NFL, for like players that have played with him. I mean, everybody hates this guy right now.
Hey, he might be going back to the Super Bowl with the Bengals. So what does that tell you? Let's stick with the NFL here for a second, because I think this is another good one too. Now, this is from a Twitter account called NFL Rumors. So take this with a grain of salt. This isn't from any kind of, you know, credible source or verified source. But NFL Rumors on Twitter has tweeted, 4 teams that are expected to check on the Rams' Jalen Ramsey's availability: the Lions, the Steelers, the Vikings, and the Raiders. So, Greg, my question for you, the Steelers possibly inquiring or possibly even acquiring Jalen Ramsey, is this a thing?
You know, it would be insane if it was, because one of the best cornerbacks in the NFL, but also one of the biggest head cases in the NFL. Here's why I don't think it's a thing. Because come draft time, if that kid from Penn State with the last name Porter is sitting there at 17, I have a feeling the Steelers are going to take him.
Wow. Here's where I am with this. Because I feel like this could be a thing for one reason and one reason only. And I happened to look up Jalen Ramsey's contract through overthecap.com. If the Steelers and Rams execute a trade before June 1st, the Rams would have $19.6 million in dead money out of a $25.2 million cap hit. So the Steelers would only be responsible for $5.6 million of that salary. That doesn't seem too unreasonable.
No,
to bring a guy in a trade. And it's not like these contracts that they have at their corner position are that hard to get rid of, because they could easily do away with the Kelly Witherspoon's contract. They could easily do away with Levi Wallace's contract if they felt like it. And they can do away with William Jackson III's contract. These are 3 contracts at the corner position that they can get rid of quickly and not have a lot of dead money. So this is, I mean, feasibly for the Steelers financially, they could actually make this work. So it comes down to, does Jalen Ramsey fit what you want to do on defense? That is the remaining question, because if they cut in Jackson the third, there's no dead money. If a color spoon, it's only $1.4 million. If they get rid of Levi Wallace, it's only $1.4 million. So you could still re-sign Cam Sutton if you want to. Dump one of those three corners and bring in Jalen Ramsey, and it's not going to cost you a lot. And if I'm going to think of a guy to get rid of to help you bring in Jalen Ramsey, you cut William Jackson III. You got $12 million to pay Jalen Ramsey and maybe pay Cam Sutton. So I think it could be a thing.
Wow.
Now, whether or not this source is actually revealing something that's true, that's an entirely different story.
Well, I checked, you know, and Yardbarker for the Steelers. Yardbarker wrote something up about this, so it's definitely out there. Sports Illustrated did too.
I think it could be a thing, and especially considering the fact the Steelers' defense has gotten a lot more, they've gotten a lot more comfortable with man coverage with their corners. So think of it this way. The Steelers could very easily cut William Jackson III, save $12 million against the cap, trade for Jalen Ramsey, pay him, pay Cam Sutton a nice amount of money in free agency, and then draft a corner.
That doesn't sound like a bad idea to me.
I'll go and say it's a thing. And let me put it to you this way. If you go to Jalen Ramsey and say, hey, you got a chance to possibly play for Mike Tomlin, I got a feeling Jalen Ramsey is going to be like, okay.
Yeah, I think so too.
I think it's a thing.
You got me excited now. I hope this is a thing.
It was one of those things where I just happened to look. I'm like, well, let me see if they can actually pull this off. Financially, they could. This is one of those Kevin Colbert gifts that keeps on giving, like when he arranged some of these offseason contracts before he went out the door. And, well, granted, the William Jackson III trade with Washington, that was an Omar Khan move. But still, they got a lot of flexibility going into the offseason, and this is one of those things they could do based on that flexibility. So stay tuned on that one. That's all I'm saying. All right, let's go to college football now. This is a fun one because for no other reason, it kind of tackles a theory I've had for quite some time now. You know as well as I do that Nick Saban has developed a reputation for rehabilitating the careers of coaches that have fallen on hard times. And they come and join his staff, and he turns their careers around. The most recent example being Bill O'Brien. Bill O'Brien was Alabama's offensive coordinator this past season. Well, he is going back to New England to be the Patriots offensive coordinator. So he's going from working for Nick Saban from one friend to working for the other friend in Belichick. So he's going from working for the apprentice to working for the Sith Lord. So think about that. There's that.
Now he just needs to work for Popovich, and he's hit all three.
Right. And he's coaching the quarterback that used to play for the apprentice and now plays for the Sith Lord. So do with that whatever you will. But this was from the Locked On Podcast Network that put this tweet out. It said, Bill O'Brien's departure from Alabama means Nick Saban is looking for his sixth different offensive coordinator in the past 8 years. Could it be Cliff Kingsbury, who was recently fired from the Arizona Cardinals? Greg, Cliff Kingsbury being the latest student to enroll at the Tuscaloosa Institute for Coaching Rehabilitation. Is this a thing?
Well, when you put it that way, I actually think that, you know, there were teams that were calling him, and he's like, hey, I'm on vacation. He gets a phone call from Alabama. I think he actually takes it. I really do. What do you have to lose? You're going to become the offensive coordinator for one of the best programs in college football. Oh, and by the way, Saban's not happy about the way that the season ended last year. So, yeah, I think it very well could be a good fit for them.
Here's the thing. When you coach under Nick Saban, you got a really good shot of landing a head coaching gig somewhere at some Division I Power 5 school. You're going to land a coaching gig somewhere because someone's going to be like, well, this guy's already a good coach, and he coached under Coach Saban, so he must be okay. Because Coach Saban apparently has like the golden hand over coaching resumes. So you're going to land somewhere eventually. But here's the other part, Greg. And this is the part that's the most exciting. You can come back from the NFL to go back to working in college football under the Sith Lord himself and having the opportunity to help rebuild an offense that's going to take on, wait for it, the Roman Reigns of college football. Because you got to try to put a team together, put an offense together that can knock off Georgia eventually. Because you get back to the SEC championship game, let's not kid ourselves, you're probably facing Georgia.
Correct.
So you get to if they call, you get a chance to join Nick Saban's staff potentially to help rebuild the offense to take down the Roman Reigns of college football. This just the storyline alone feels like a thing.
It sounds like a good time to me. Like, why wouldn't you take that?
That's what I'm saying. This sounds like a thing. This definitely sounds like a thing. I hope it's a thing. I want it to be a thing. I really want it to be a thing. It's crazy, man. I would love to see something like this happen. I think it would be funny, but I don't. Man, could you imagine that staff at Alabama? But, Nick Saban walks out with Cliff Kingsbury running his offense, and they're running air raid plays in Alabama. Could you imagine?
And yet Kirby's just sitting there smirking, like, "Oh, you thought, huh?"
Oh man, it's like Kirby's asking Nick Saban, "Is that the best you could do?" And Saban walks out with Cliff Kingsbury, and they're running the air raid, and Todd Monken standing next to Kirby, like in Avengers Ultron, Age of Ultron, and Todd Monken stands up next to Kirby and says, "You had to ask." You had to ask. This feels like a thing, man. I think that'd be hilarious.
It would
Alabama
be,
running the air raid. Oh my god.
It would be extremely fun.
That would be fun. Thanos. Oh my god, that'd be Thanos getting all the Infinity Stones. It'd be insane. Alabama athletes running the air raid offense under Cliff Kingsbury playing for Nick Saban. Oh god.
Imagine the video that Molinaro puts out with Kingsbury talking to Saban.
I want this now. That not only do I think it's a thing, I actually want this to happen. I'm manifesting this and putting this out to the universe. Nick Saban, if you haven't called him already, please call Cliff Kingsbury and make my year. Please. Please. Please.
Please. On that note, I think that'll do it for us. This has been episode 61 of the Sunday Morning Grind podcast, brought to you by Ethos Life. For Josh Taylor, I'm Greg Finley. We'll talk to you next week.